So thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak, and I'll be here until about May 15th, so there's lots of time for questions, should you have any. And the talk today will be based primarily on two papers. The first will be one that came out in December with my collaborators Miranda Chang at the University of Amsterdam, her grad student Francesca Ferrari, and Sarah Harrison, who's a postdoc at Harvard. And if I have time, I'll also talk about a more recent paper, that appeared last month with my advisor, Shamit Patru at Stanford, and Roberto Volpato, who's also at Stanford. So the plan of the talk is going to be as follows. As any moonshine talk goes, I have to start by reminding you of the story of monstrous moonshine. So moonshine, as I'll explain, is a piece of mathematics that brings together two subfields of mathematics that are a priori unrelated and connects them in a precise way. And monstrous moonshine was historically the first and is also the best understood example of moonshine. So I'll explain a bit the mathematical and physical context of monstrous moonshine, its explanation, and the reason for these two branches of mathematics being brought together in the way that they are. And then from there, I'll go on to talk about newer moonshines that have appeared in the past 6 years or so, namely Mathieu and Umbral moonshine. And Mathieu moonshine in particular is perhaps a more exciting problem for string theorists because it brings in a string theoretic object that's very beloved, namely the K3 surface. So just to remind you, the K3 surface is the unique, compact, simply connected Calabi-Yau manifold in two complex dimensions. So if you'd like to compactify string theory down to six dimensions, preserving supersymmetry, your options are the K3 surface with a four-dimensional torus. And so K3 surfaces, namely compactifications on them, preserve a lot of supersymmetry. They make great test beds for calculations that we'd like to do in string theory. They played a central role in many string dualities. And they've appeared in many computations, early examples of the ADS-CFT correspondence, counting of black hole microstates in string theory, and so on and so forth. So because of the central role played by K3 in a lot of beautiful parts of string theory, if there is a new piece of mathematics, namely a moonshine that's underlying some of the physics of string theory or conformal field theory on K3 surfaces, I think it really behooves us to understand what's going on. And so that would be the story of Mathieu moonshine that I'll turn to next in the talk. And from there, I'll explain a new set of moonshines discovered even more recently called the umbral moonshines, which are 23 instances of moonshine, of which the Mathieu moonshine observation is actually a special case. So we might hope to understand the Mathieu moonshine observation from the perspective of understanding this larger set of moonshines, of which M24 moonshine is a subcase. And so I'll explain all of that. And then from there, I'll go into the motivation for my own work, which is, in particular, what is the connection, the precise connection between all 23 instances of umbral moonshine and physics on K3. And from there, I'll discuss the work with Chang, Harrison, and Ferrari. Namely, we studied a class of very symmetric Landau-Ginzburg orbifold models that are known to flow to points on the moduli space of K3 CFTs, and show that discrete symmetries of these models do indeed implicate all 23 instances of umbral moonshine in physics on K3. And then from there, I'll describe the more recent paper with Patru and Volpato, where we find a precise string theoretic compactification down to three dimensions involving K3, where we find symmetries of all 23 of the umbral groups appearing. So that's the plan. And so first, the primary question, what is moonshine? Now, broadly speaking, moonshine is some kind of relationship that I'll endeavor to make precise throughout the talk that connects, on the one hand, finite groups, and on the other hand, modular forms. So these are two very a priori disparate branches of mathematics. We have group theorists, we have number theorists, perhaps they don't talk to each other. So before I explain the connection that moonshine brings between these two classes of mathematics, let me introduce the two objects on either side of this relation. And the first is finite groups. Now, in moonshine, the examples of finite groups that show up, at least in the best known and most well understood cases of moonshine, are what are called the 26 simple sporadic groups. So mathematicians classified all finite simple groups in a Herculean effort that took many years and many mathematicians, and they found the following result. So finite simple groups fall into two broad categories. On the one hand, there are 18 infinite families that consist of some more pedestrian finite groups that we're probably all familiar with. For instance, the cyclic group of order n, or the alternating group of even permutations on n elements, and so on. And in addition to these 18 infinite families, there are these 26 oddballs in the classification, So you might want to think of them as the analog of the exceptional groups in the ADE classification. These are sort of the exceptional structures that appear in the classification of finite simple groups, and they're called the sporadics. And the hero of the first part of the story will be the monster group, which is the largest of the 26 sporadics. So the way that you should just read this diagram is that I've displayed all of the 26 simple sporadic groups. The larger groups are on top, and if groups below are connected to groups on top by a line, it means the lower groups are just subgroups of the groups on top. And so in addition to the monster group, just to give you a preview, I'll also be talking a lot about the Conway group, which not only has an interesting moonshine story of its own that's analogous to monstrous moonshine, which unfortunately I won't have too much time to talk about, but it will also play a role in classifying symmetries of K3 sigma models. So the Conway group will appear again. And of course, the Mathieu group M24 will really be the star of the second part of the talk, and some of its subgroups will also show up in other cases of umbral moonshine. So that's the first half of the cast of characters of moonshine. And on the other hand, I promise that there are modular forms, which are perhaps already much more familiar to string theorists, because we're very used to, for instance, computing genus 1 partition functions or supersymmetric indices on the world sheet, as we'll be doing a lot in this talk. And we also see them showing up in space-time quantities if a theory has S-duality symmetry, and so on. So just to remind you of the definition, a modular form f of tau is a function defined on the upper half plane that transforms with respect to either SL2z or some subgroup thereof in the following covariant way that's governed by this parameter k that's called the weight of the modular form. And in particular, if it's a modular form under all of SL2z, we'll demand that it transform nicely under the generators S and T of the group SL2z. So those are the two primary ingredients that I want to start out with. And somehow they're going to be brought together into this edifice that I've called moonshine in some way that I'll make precise. And just to give you a bit of a preview or to acclimate you to the ideas that will be in play, at least for monstrous moonshine, you should think of these two extremely special and symmetric objects as two different avatars of symmetries that appear in string theory, namely the world sheet and the space-time symmetries. So on the one hand, we have these very nice functions that are transforming with respect to the group of large diffeomorphisms of the torus, which you should think about as the world sheet. And on the other hand, we have these exotic finite groups that will be appearing more in the space-time side of moonshine. And so that's how you can get a bit of a feel for how string theory or conformal field theory will bring together these two symmetric objects in a consistent way. And so let me make all of this precise with monstrous moonshine. Now, the story of monstrous moonshine starts with a modular function called the J function, meaning it transforms as a form of weight zero, or as invariant, under all of SL2z. So in particular, I've displayed the invariants under the S and T transformations. And because the T transformation just takes tau to tau plus one, it's just a periodicity condition, it's convenient for us to define this new variable Q, which is defined as e to the 2 pi I tau, to account for that symmetry already. And once we do that, the J function has a very nice Fourier expansion in terms of the variable Q. And the instigating observation of monstrous moonshine was made by the mathematician John McKay in 78. And he correctly observed, looking at the first coefficient of the Fourier expansion, that 196884 is 1 plus 196883. And you can make a host of similar looking observations for the higher Fourier coefficients. Now, that's certainly a true equation, but why on earth should it be interesting? Well, the numbers on the right-hand side that I've colored in are just dimensions of irreducible representations of the largest of those 26 simple sporadic groups, the monster group. And just to give you a sense for how large it is, it's on the order of 10 to the 54 elements. So it's really a gargantuan structure. And as I mentioned, a priori, there's no reason for the monster group to know anything about the J function at all, or vice versa. So this is the start of the moonshine observation. And the name moonshine has many possible explanations, but one way you can think about it, or at least one of the many proposed reasons for the name of the field, is that it seems that there's something very a priori surprising or illicit happening, and you're only seeing sort of reflected glimpses of the true underlying structure by making these numerological observations, like looking at sunlight reflected from the moon. Or you can think of it as relating to whiskey, which some people prefer to do. But after this observation by McKay and related observations decomposing the coefficients into monster ereps by Thompson as well, the mathematicians Conway and Norton codified a set of conjectures called the monstrous moonshine conjectures, which made precise in a way that I'll get into more detail about later, the way in which the J function really knows about the monster group. So this is a set of conjectures that's really trying to make precise that this isn't just some spurious numerological observation. There's actually a deep sense in which there's a structure that knows about both of these mathematical objects. And, well, I'll tell you the important object right away. The key object in play is just going to be a chiral conformal field theory whose partition function is the J function and which enjoys a monster group symmetry. So from this perspective, the monstrous moonshine observation will be nothing but the very natural statement that you have some chiral conformal field theory whose symmetries are just the monster group, and so that it's not a surprise that the partition function, the coefficients of the partition function, will be decomposing with respect to the symmetry group, as we expect states in a theory to do. And to be a little bit more precise, the conformal field theory in question happens to be a theory of 24 chiral bosons on a very special lattice called the Leech lattice, and I'll say more about the Leech lattice later in the talk, up to a Z2 orbifold. And I'll be more precise about the definition of the Leech lattice later, but one way to think about it is that it's the structure that tells you the most optimal way to pack spheres in 24 dimensions. So again, moonshine is bringing together a host of extremely symmetric and very special objects in mathematics and putting them together in a very precise way. And I should also say historically that this chiral CFT was really first constructed by mathematicians, Frankel, Lepowski, and Merman, and I believe they introduced the orbifold procedure before physicists did. So they were really ahead of us on that score. And after the construction of this moonshine module, or this theory, the monstrous moonshine conjectures were proved by Borchards in his Fields Medal winning work, which introduced some interesting new mathematics and had some pieces of the proof that were inspired by physics. And so monstrous moonshine is a very nice story. That's almost all I'm going to say about it. But I also want to stress that the monster CFT has shown up more recently in studies of three-dimensional gravity in ADS3 CFT2. And so there are interesting applications of the monster CFT even now that unfortunately I won't have time to go into. But before I move on to the set of new moonshines, I'd like to say a bit more about the monstrous moonshine conjectures and the nature of the monstrous moonshine conjectures, because we'll soon be in a position analogous to that of the mathematicians studying moonshine before they knew about the Frankel-Lepowski-Merman module. Namely, we'll have some set of functions, and we'll need to figure out if the observations that we're making are spurious or contentful. And so the monstrous moonshine conjectures basically help us answer the question, if we didn't know the existence of this monster module, how would we get evidence that there is actually a structure on which the monster group acts that knows about the J function? And so the procedure is as follows. As usual, if we have some putative theory, we'll be grading by energy eigenvalues. And here I start at -1 because the monster CFT is a theory of 24 chiral bosons. So -C/24 is just -1. And at each energy level, we're proposing a decomposition of the theory into monster irreducible representations. So rho naught is just shorthand for the singlet representation. In particular, the ground state should be invariant under the monster group action. At the first energy level, we're proposing the decomposition rho 1 plus rho naught, the 1 plus 196883, where rho 1 is the irrep of dimension 196883, and so on and so forth. And then what one does is study what are called the McKay-Thompson series. And again, I want to stress this because analogs of these will appear later in the Mathieu moonshine. Sorry. And so for each element G of the monster group, rather than just computing the usual partition function, what you'd like to do is compute the partition function twined by an additional insertion of this group element G. So of course, if G were the identity element, we'd just be computing the partition function all over again. And then the trace of the group element in the particular representations at each energy level are exactly just the dimensions of the representations that appear. But more generally, if we have some non-trivial group element, then we should instead have here the correct traces of the group element in a given representation. In group theory, these are just called the characters. And so if we propose a decomposition, we should get a set of self-consistent series for each group element that we insert. And importantly, these also have to be modular functions. But now they're under functions that transform with respect to subgroups of SL2Z rather than SL2Z itself, because the insertion of the group element will just break some of the manifest SL2Z symmetry. So these consistency conditions together are extremely constraining. And if one can build all of these McKay-Thompson series, one for each conjugacy class of the monster, then that's an extremely non-trivial test that the monstrous moonshine observation really has meaning, and that there is such a structure, V natural or a CFT, that's underlying these observations.
Roughly, how many reps does the monster have?
So 194. So right, rather than computing, so because the trace is cyclic, it will only depend on the conjugacy class, which is the same as the number of ereps. And so rather than computing 10 to the 54 functions, we only have to compute 194, which is, you know, a bit better. And so now I'd like to transition to the newer moonshine observations that have appeared recently. And the McGee moonshine observation in particular starts with a slightly different modular object, a different class of modular object than just the modular form. It will introduce a number theoretic concept called the Jacobi form. And in particular, for the physicists, I'll just be studying an elliptic genus. So let's just consider a two-dimensional superconformal field theory with n equals 2, a copy of the n equals 2 superconformal algebra on the left and the right. And the elliptic genus is defined in the usual way. I take the trace over the Ramon-Ramon sector, and I have my usual Q and Q bar with a minus 1 to both the left and right moving fermion numbers. And in addition, because the n equals 2 superconformal algebra has a U1R current, then additionally, I'd like to choose to grade by the left-moving U1R charges as well. And the elliptic genus is a very nice object, in particular because I'm not grading by the right-moving U1R charges, though a priori I could choose to do that. But in particular, you notice that just grading by the left movers, the right-moving sector basically just depends on this Q bar and minus 1 to the FR. So you should roughly think of the elliptic genus as acting like a Witten index on the right movers, and the elliptic genus will then localize onto the right-moving ground states. But nonetheless, I'll have a non-trivial holomorphic function of tau and z, where z is the chemical potential for the U1 charge, that will give me a lot of information about the left-moving BPS states of the theory. And so the elliptic genus, as I mentioned, has these nice properties. It's a holomorphic index. It's constant on a connected component of the moduli space. So in particular, if I want to study a particular theory, I can go to any convenient point on the moduli space, compute it there, and it will be I'll have the same answer everywhere. And as I mentioned, it's a special modular object called a weak Jacobi form. So I'll have the precise definition on the next slide. But just to say, in addition to the modular transformations, which of course we also still demand since we're computing the elliptic genus on the torus, we would also like this function to transform nicely with respect to what's called an elliptic transformation, or this quasi-periodicity property, which is just a manifestation of the spectral flow symmetry inherited from the underlying n equals 2 superconformal field theory. And so, just to give you the precise definition, we say a Jacobi form of weight K and index M transforms in the following way, where again K just governs the modular transformation, and M, called the index, is what's telling you the phase you should pick up under this new spectral flow transformation. And a Jacobi form is called weak if it has no negative powers of Q in the Fourier expansion, and for us that's basically automatic because we're computing the trace in the Ramon-Ramon sector. And the particular elliptic genus that I'll be interested in is that of a sigma model with target space K3, which in particular has n equals 4, 4 superconformal, superconformal algebra on the left and right, and it's at central charge 6. And the elliptic genus of this theory was computed a long time ago. And as I mentioned, you can just go to your favorite point in moduli space, like a Geffner point. And the computation was done by EOTY, Iguchi, Iguri, Tarmina, and Yang, and you get a particular answer. But the McGee moonshine observation requires one more non-trivial step. And in particular, since the left movers enjoy an n equals 4 symmetry, we should be able to decompose the elliptic genus in terms of characters of the n equals 4 superconformal algebra. And that's what they do. And this, in particular, the observation was made by Iguchi, Iguri, and Tachikawa in 2010. So this is a very recent observation, but you find the following thing. Well, the first term will come from the short characters of the n equals 4 algebra, so there are just 24 copies of short characters, and there's an infinite set of long or non-BPS representations. And the McGee moonshine observation just comes from looking at these highlighted numbers. In particular, the numbers in red that are counting the long n equals 4 multiplets are just dimensions of ereps of another simple sporadic group, namely the McGee group M24, which is another reasonably large sporadic group. In particular, it has about 10 to the 8 elements. So it's not quite on the level of the monster, but you know, it's a pretty formidable symmetry. And if it's underlying some of the physics of CFT or string theory on K3, we'd like to know about it and where it comes from. So that was the instigating observation. And the next thing that we're primed to do after learning about the monstrous moonshine story is to compute what are called twining genera, which are the analogs of the McKay-Thompson series, where again, we just define the twining genera as the elliptic genus with an additional insertion of a group element G in the trace. So the twining genera were computed by groups for various groups of people for all M24 conjugacy classes. And again, they satisfy particular Jacobi transformation properties with respect to subgroups of SLTZ and so on. The decomposition into EREPs of M24 does seem to be consistent. So we have this set of functions. And indeed, at certain points in moduli space, we can actually compute the elliptic genus with this insertion of a symmetry group element, if a point has the symmetry, and check that it matches the proposed twining genera computed by these groups. So that's nice. We have a self-consistent set of functions that seems to be giving us evidence that M24 is not a spurious observation. And now the question is, where is the M24 symmetry? And your first thought might be, well, the elliptic genus is constant over the moduli space, so perhaps at some point in the moduli space, there's a very special symmetric K3 surface whose groups of discrete symmetries just happen to be M24 on the nodes. But we know that that's actually not true. This classification was done by the mathematician Mukai in the late 80s, and he told us that all of the geometric symmetries of K3, for any K3 surface, are subgroups of M23, which is itself a subgroup of M24. So geometric symmetries are too small by several steps to account for the full M24 observation. And so the next thought might be, well, we don't necessarily just care about the geometry. We really want to study a sigma model with target space K3, or more generally, just any point on the moduli space of K3 conformal field theories. So perhaps if we look at the symmetries of the full conformal field theories on K3, we can enhance to the full M24. So that's a natural guess. And this classification was done by Gabriel Hoheneger and Volpato. I'll refer to it a lot in the talk, so I'll probably call it the GHV classification for short. And they found the following thing, which I'll explain in a couple steps. So firstly, this classification of symmetries tells us that all such sigma model symmetries are certain subgroups of a Conway group called Conway 0, which is very closely related to the sporadic Conway group I had on the first slide. Now, M24 itself is a subgroup of the Conway group, so you might ask if M24 is one of the groups allowed by this classification, but in fact it's not. So firstly, we can say that there's no theory on the moduli space that has M24 as its group of symmetries. Now, your next thought might be, well, again, the elliptic genus is constant over the moduli space, so perhaps I don't need a theory at a single point to have the M24 symmetry. Perhaps I just need different points at the moduli. I need to realize all of the twining genera at different points in the moduli space and somehow assemble it into M24. But based on the classification, again, what we find is that actually not all twining genera are actually realized at points in the K3 moduli space. So in particular, there might be there's a group element G of order 23, in M24. There's a twining genus we can write down for it, but there's not actually a sigma model or CFT that has a symmetry of order 23. So we can never actually realize that symmetry in a physical sigma model. So again, this classification is telling us that we just don't have all of M24, even though the symmetries that we do have seem to be consistent with the M24 twining genera. And moreover, based on this classification, there are symmetries that lie outside of M24 but still in Conway that do appear. And they show up, you know, you can't get rid of them. And so somehow the classification tells us that sigma model symmetries or CFT symmetries are both too big and too small. We get stuff outside of M24, but we can never physically realize all of the M24 symmetries that we'd really need for an M24 module. But there's also been some formal progress. The mathematician Terry Gannon proved in 2012 a theorem, which is a purely number theoretic theorem. It's not constructive. But what he proves is that there does indeed exist some graded M24 module such that the twining genera of this module coincide with a computed one. So there's some structure. It's not clear if it's a conformal field theory or something related to K3, but there's some structure whose graded traces give you the right functions. So that's nice, but again, it's not constructive, so it doesn't tell us where to look. And so consequently, there's been a lot of work by many different groups trying many different avenues to try and achieve the full M24 somewhere in string theory and conformal field theory. And I won't go into all of these different ideas, but they're all interesting and promising in different ways. And I would say so far it's not yet clear which, if any, is the right idea, but all certainly worth pursuing. So what I'd like to tell you about next is actually Umbral Moonshine, of which M24 Moonshine is a special case. And I'd like to tell you about the structure in the hopes that it will give us sort of a uniform way to look for M24 symmetries as well as the other umbral symmetries that will show up. So hopefully we can understand M24 Moonshine through the lens of this larger abstract structure. But in order to introduce umbral moonshine, I first need to introduce one more number theoretic or modular type object that will really be the important object rather than the Jacobi form for the umbral moonshine story. And in particular, let me remind you of our old friend, which I've called H of tau. You might remember that this is the piece in the decomposition of the K3 elliptic genus that was counting the long multiplets and in particular exhibited the M24 eros. And so this piece of the elliptic genus might be what you really want to focus on if you want to focus on understanding the M24 symmetry. But what is this object? It's what's actually called a Mach modular form. So in particular, a Mach modular form, which I've defined as F of tau, is a holomorphic function that is not actually a modular form at all. But it turns out that it can be improved or completed into a modular form in a very precise way. So it fails to be modular, but it fails to be modular in an extremely precise way that we can correct with some precise prescription. But we do this at the cost of the holomorphicity of the object. So f hat is now a function of both tau and tau bar, but it is a genuine modular form. And f tau is this holomorphic piece. And just to give you a flavor for the fact that these objects don't actually come out of nowhere, Mach modularity has shown up in at least these two places in physics. I won't go too much into the details of Mach modularity in physics, but for one thing, short characters of superconformal algebras with extended supersymmetry are known to be Mach modular forms. So in particular, even the short character that was that other piece of the elliptic genus in my K3 decomposition was a Mach modular form as well. And so in particular, the short character and H tau together can be put together as a nice modular object, even though the two separate pieces are Mach themselves. And there are also interesting geometric origins for Mach modularity that I won't go too much into. But just to give you the feeling that these objects do seem to be showing up in increasingly more places in physics. And so now that I've told you what a Mach modular form is, I can finally answer the question, at least partly, what is umbral moonshine? So umbral moonshine was proposed by Chang, Duncan, and Harvey in 2013. It's a set of 23 instances of moonshine, as I said, of which M24 is a special case. And in particular, it's a relationship between a set of finite groups and now a set of Mach modular forms. And one of the nice things about umbral moonshine, although so far it's a purely mathematical construction, is that there's a uniform prescription to get the finite groups and the Mach modular forms for all 23 instances of umbral moonshine. I'll tell you a little bit about what this prescription is, but there's a uniform set of objects that are key to this construction. So I mentioned the Leech lattice earlier in the talk. The Leech lattice is an even self-dual lattice in 24 dimensions, and it's actually the unique even self-dual lattice in 24 dimensions that has no vectors of length squared 2, or no roots. But it turns out that if you look at all even self-dual lattices in 24 dimensions, there are exactly 24 of them, and the other 23 are called the Niemeyer lattices, and indeed they have non-trivial root systems. And moreover, you can actually label each Niemeyer lattice by their root systems. So once you've specified that you have a particular root system, and additionally you specify that you want an even self-dual lattice, the Niemeyer lattice is fixed. So I'll always label the Niemeyer lattices by the root systems, and in particular, the root systems are rank 24 unions of simple ADE root systems. So the simplest example is just 24 copies of the A1 root system, 12 copies of A2, and so on and so forth. You'll see that there's 23 of them that you can write down, satisfying an additional technical condition. So this is the preview for umbral moonshine. I'll tell you what both of these objects are on the next slide, but just to get you a little bit oriented, start with the Niemeyer lattice, whose root system is 24 copies of A1. The finite group that I'll call the umbral group that you associate to this lattice will be M24, and the Mach modular form that you also associate with this lattice will be H of tau, the piece of the elliptic genus that's encoding M24 characters. And there will be 22 other cases analogously to that. So let me sketch the ingredients somewhat briefly. So again, X is our union of ADE root systems, and for each Niemeyer lattice, first we should ask how can we get a finite group. And that's actually very simple. The umbral group, as they're called, just comes from taking the odd morphism group of the Niemeyer lattice and modding out by the Weyl reflections of the root system. So the finite group part is very straightforward and just comes about naturally from the lattice. The Mach modular form side of the story is a bit more technical, and I don't want to go into too many details because I don't think it's extremely illuminating at this point, but I want to stress the following part of the construction, which is namely the only information taken from the Niemeyer lattice to construct the Mach modular forms is really just the ADE classification that comes from the root systems. So in particular, Cheng, Duncan, and Harvey build up these Mach modular forms by just using another structure that has the same ADE classification as the Niemeyer root systems. And if you happen to already be familiar with these objects, I'll just tell you that the objects that they use are the Capelli, Itzigsohn, and Joubert matrices that are famous from the classification of n equals 2 minimal models. So these matrices are known to have an ADE structure, and they're used to build up Mach modular forms. So that's all I want to say about that for now. But again,
The statement is not that the elliptic genus or whatever of the minimal models are the Mach modular forms, because those are compact CFTs.
Yeah, absolutely. We're just taking the Capelli, Itzigsohn, and Joubert matrices. So in the n equals 2 context, those were used to glue together the left and right moving characters into modular invariant partition functions.
Yeah.
But in this case, they're actually going to be used to construct what was called the shadow function, which will specify the Mach modular form. So it's really just that the matrices appear in both places, and they have some ADE classification.
I mean, will you have a geometric CFT interpretation of the Mach modular form?
Unfortunately, no. There's no good CFT interpretation. In particular, there's a hope that ultimately we will find some kind of non-compact space, perhaps, such that at least the completion of the Mach modular form would show up. But it's not known yet. That's definitely been sort of the motivating question for a lot of work on umbral moonshine in physics. And I'll have a little bit more to say about that later in the talk, at least in the context of our work. But yeah, I would say it's not known at this point. It's not fully understood. So again, just to stress, even though these two objects come from a uniform place, they can all be constructed from the Niemeyer lattices, a priori the two things are completely unrelated, again, or seemingly unrelated. We just have some functions that seem to know something about the ADE structure of the Niemeyer lattices, and on the other hand, we have groups which are genuinely coming from the automorphisms of the lattices. And yet it turns out that the Mach modular forms and their Twine generalizations do genuinely encode EREPs of the umbral group. But this is still having the flavor of a mysterious moonshine observation, because again, we don't have an underlying theory that's explaining both sides of the picture. But again, just to say, an analog of the number theoretic proof by Terry Gannon was done for all cases of umbral moonshine by Duncan, Griffin, and Ono. So again, we know that modules exist, but we don't know what they are. Although I should say that there's a recent example in the literature by Duncan and Harvey for one case of umbral moonshine. But I think, again, we would really like to have a uniform set of 23 modules that have a consistent origin from which we can drive all instances of umbral moonshine. So let me just pause for a minute to recap the important points of what I've said so far before I go in to our work. Namely, the Mathieu moonshine observation arose in the elliptic genus of K3, and some but not all of the twining genera for Mathieu moonshine appear in sigma models on K3. But on the other hand, Mathieu moonshine is formulated as a special case of the so far totally abstract mathematical structure that's umbral moonshine. And so the question is, what is the physical or geometric context for all 23 cases of umbral moonshine? And in particular, does it have anything to do with K3? And so this is where I'll be going in the rest of the talk. So first, I'll briefly review work by Cheng and Harrison, where they showed that umbral moonshine, all 23 cases, can show up in novel decompositions of the elliptic genus of K3. And then I'll summarize my work with Cheng, Harrison, and Ferrari, where indeed we showed that all 23 cases of umbral moonshine are important for describing and categorizing symmetries of K3 CFTs. And so we'll find various symmetric points on the moduli space of K3 CFTs that really give us modules for subgroups of the umbral groups, as well as subgroups of the Conway group, which again just comes from that classification. And so this is the first real indication that we should be thinking about all of the umbral groups, as well as the Conway group, for trying to understand the symmetries underlying K3 sigma models. But of course, as I've already stressed from the classification, We know that Sigma models or CFTs can't be the complete story for understanding Mathieu moonshine or any of the cases of Arnbull moonshine completely. And so so at the end of the talk, I'll describe my more recent work with Cacho and Volpato, where we do realize full umbral group symmetries and the full Conway group symmetry, in particular string compactifications, down to 3 dimensions. So I hope I have some time to talk about that towards the end. So first, let me explain how on Earth all 23 cases of umbral moonshine might actually show up and be relevant to the elliptic genus of K3. And the basic idea of Chang and Harrison was to relate this ADE classification of the Niemeyer lattices that I've stressed so much to a different ADE classification that has relevance for K3. Namely, the singularities that a K3 surface can develop also have a famous ADE classification. They're sometimes called the Kleinian or Duval singularities. And there are many ways to see the ADE classification of these singularities. Let me focus on, I think, perhaps the simplest one, which is to say, if you zoom in on a singular point on some K3 surface, you'd like to resolve a singularity. And you do that by blowing up the singularity by adding spheres, essentially, in a particular way, without changing, you know, the first turn class of your manifold. And the way you can do that is prescribed by exactly ADE Dinkin diagrams. So you should think of the nodes as the spheres that you're allowed to use to blow up the geometry, and the edges between them tell you if they're intersecting or not. So the intersection matrix for these smooth rational curves that you get from the resolutions are exactly, they have this ADE Dinkin structure. So for example, if you were looking at a particular K3, namely the toroidal orbifold T4 mod Z2, it has 16 A1 type singularities that can be resolved. Or alternatively, you might look at another toroidal orbifold, K3, T4 mod Z3, and there's one such orbifold whose singularity structure is 9 copies of A2, so that's 18 curves that are intersecting pairwise. And so given this motivation to somehow link the ADE structures that are present in the problem, I now want to invite you to rethink the N=4 decomposition of the elliptic genus. And the way to do that will really be the following observation. One can compute the elliptic genus of a sigma model whose target is one of these ADE singularities. So this is the elliptic genus of some ALE space. It's like a local model, say, for a K3 surface. And there's a very explicit CFT description of these sigma models by Oguri and Bafa. So you can compute the elliptic genus, and you find in particular that the elliptic genus of a sigma model whose target space was an A1 type singularity, that's exactly the same function that you get as a short N=4 character. So in particular, the first term in the elliptic genus, which was formerly 24 copies of a short N=4 character, you might want to try and reinterpret that as 24 copies of an A1 singularity. And given this motivation, what you can prove, and this is a purely formal decomposition so far, but you can show that you can indeed rewrite the elliptic genus in 23 different ways, one for each instance of umbral moonshine, where the first term is just governed by the ADE classification of the Niemeyer root system, where you include the appropriate number of copies of the ADE singularity, of the elliptic genus of the ADE singularities, plus some other part that depends only on the umbral Mach modular form. So it turns out, so there's a precise and uniform way to do this. I only wrote the first example on the slide, but it's proven that you can do this. And so you have 23 new decompositions of the elliptic genus, and you have 2 terms that depend on the umbral Mach modular forms and the ADE root systems. So that's nice, and it's perhaps suggestive or inspiring.
Are these 23 or 24 decompositions unique? I mean, are they the only decompositions like that you can do? Or
It's not proven that they're the only decompositions you can make entirely, but for instance, I can't put other non-Niemeyer ADE pieces there and get a consistent elliptic genus. So if I said I'd like to split the elliptic genus in some way that depends only on some ADE singularities plus some other stuff, this is, I believe, the only way in which I can make the splitting these 23 ways. So the splitting is nice and suggestive, but the question is, of course, are these decompositions physically meaningful, or is this just some formal thing that one can do? And so the first thing, which was also done by Chang and Harrison, is to refine and test the conjecture that this decomposition is meaningful and that umbral moonshine should really appear in the elliptic genus of K3. So in particular, they computed the twinings in a prescribed way for all 23 of these decompositions. And of course, the first case coincides with all the twining genera of Mathieu moonshine, which we've already seen, and there are 22 other sets of twined functions. So you have a set of predictions, and now the question is, well, we should test them by actually studying symmetries in the K3 moduli space. So in particular, what they do is they compute the twinings for some geometric symmetries, which is to say symmetries under the purview of that Mackay classification earlier in the talk, geometric symmetries. And so they go to some toroidal orbifold point, which is one of the only places in moduli space where we can actually compute anything. So this is a practical choice. And there, the geometric symmetries are just interpreted as permutations of smooth rational curves. And you can check, indeed, that you do get agreement with all of the umbral twinings for the geometric symmetries. So the umbral twinings seem, for all 23 cases of umbral moonshine, reproduce the right geometric symmetries. But what I want to stress is that for these low-order geometric symmetries, all of the twining functions across all cases of umbral moonshine are actually the same. They're the same twining genera that we saw from M24, and they're the same for all other 22 cases. So it's nice and consistent that we get the right twining genera for these different decompositions, but how do we actually know that different umbral groups are playing a role? Why can't we just think of all of these functions as just coming from M24 and our original N=4 decomposition? So that's the question. And what we need to do to really test if the other umbral groups are relevant are to look at non-geometric symmetries where the twining genera start to diverge. And so we'll have different twining predictions from the M24 case of umbral moonshine than we will from some of the other cases. So we need to actually check which twining functions show up. Do we just get the M24 ones in sigma model symmetries, or do we get the functions predicted by the other instances of umbral moonshine? And in particular, in my work with Chang, Harrison, and Ferrari, we studied a class of Landau-Ginzburg orbifold models with extremely symmetric superpotentials that we know to flow to the moduli space of K3 CFTs. And essentially, this is a very pragmatic choice. Landau-Ginzburg models are really the only way, other than toroidal orbifolds, where we can actually compute the twining genera in explicit models. And because we can write down fairly generic superpotentials, we really have access to a larger span of the moduli space. We have access to more symmetries than we did before. And of course, the elliptic genera of the Landau-Ginzburg model coincides with the elliptic genera of the CFT to which it flows. So we just have access to symmetries in the IR that are just manifest in these Landau-Ginzburg superpotentials, which are just some simple polynomials and chiral superfields. So it's a very nice and clean set of models to study if we're interested in large discrete symmetry groups. And this is an old story that I won't review, but just to say that the elliptic genus in the Landau-Ginzburg theory permits a nice free field description, and the twining genera can be computed in much the same way. So there's very explicit expressions for the twining genera. So what did we find? Well, so first let me just focus on a particularly symmetric class of superpotentials that are known to flow to the K3 moduli space, which is namely cubic superpotentials in six chiral superfields. So the simplest example of this is just the Fermat superpotential, and we know that that flows to the famous 1^6 Geppner point on K3. But of course, we don't need to restrict ourselves to the Fermat superpotential. We can study any such cubic superpotential in six variables as long as it's transverse and so on and so forth. And it turns out that there are six such equations, six superpotentials in the chiral superfields that are maximally symmetric. So in this class of models, these are absolutely the most symmetric things that you can write down, and they have some classification of finite groups. Now, the details of the groups and the equations are not terribly important, so let me stress what's the important thing. So again, just to show that we can compute the twining genera for these models readily, let me focus on one particularly interesting example. So let me focus on this one superpotential, and its discrete symmetry group is a certain finite group that has the name L211. So the details of the group are not important, but what is important? Well, first of all, as a subgroup, on the one hand, it's a subgroup of M24, but it's also a subgroup of this group 2.M12. It's a double cover of another Mathieu group, and in particular, it's the umbral group associated to the Niemeyer lattice whose root system is 12 copies of A2. So group theoretically, nothing is telling us that we should view this symmetry as coming from M24 or coming from the other case of Umbral Moonshine related to that Niemeyer lattice with root system 12 copies of A2. So of course, we compute the twining function. And in particular, there's one extremely explicit and very simple symmetry of the superpotential that you can just see right away. There's some phase rotation of order 11 by these chiral superfields. So you can just plug in these phases, check that it leaves the superpotential invariant, and just check the twining function. And it turns out that the twining function you get singles out the 2.M12 case of Umbral Moonshine and not the M24 case of Umbral Moonshine. So a priori, for an order 11 symmetry, there was an option, there's an M24 order 11 twining function for that conjugacy class. There's also a 2.M12 twining function for that conjugacy class. And essentially, we could have gotten either one. So we just explicitly computed and found that indeed, we have to view some of the symmetries of K3 sigma models as coming from Umbral groups that are not necessarily M24. All 23 cases of Umbral Moonshine show up in genuine symmetries of K3 CFTs. So that's the punchline. And you can play this game for other symmetries of high order, for all six of the superpotentials. And again, we find even more cases of Umbral Moonshine showing up as being singled out by the functions that we compute, as well as the Conway group. And similarly, you can play this game with other symmetric classes of Landau-Ginzburg-Orbifold theories. You can do this as much as you like. And again, just to stress, the high-order symmetries, the non-geometric symmetries, really single out functions other than the M24 twining functions. Or rather, sometimes the M24 twining function is preferred, sometimes the other Umbral group twining function is preferred. So let me just pause to summarize what we've said so far. So pragmatically, Landau-Ginzburg orbifolds are just examples of models that have large and reasonably transparent discrete symmetry groups in the UV. They're symmetries acting on some polynomial, and we can classify the groups, and so we can twine by every symmetry enjoyed by those superpotentials. And we know they flow to superconformal fixed points on the moduli space of K3 sigma models, so we're accessing some fairly large IR symmetries. So that's very nice. And we compute the twining genera in a free field approximation, and we found many examples of twining functions that are unique to certain Umbral groups. They coincide with the predictions of Chang and Harrison for M24 as well as non-M24 Umbral groups. And this tells us that all cases of Umbral Moonshine do seem to be relevant for the study of K3 sigma models, although there's still an obvious open question of how do we explain when certain Umbral groups appear at certain points in the moduli space. For instance, is there a good explanation for why that 2.M12 Umbral group appeared instead of the M24 Umbral group? Because a priori, the order 11 symmetry could have given us either function. So that I haven't explained yet, and that's an open question. But perhaps the more pressing question, or the most obvious question, is, well, it's nice to study K3 sigma models. They're concrete. We can compute a lot of things. But we've known from the GHV classification that they were never going to be the full story. We know that we couldn't get all of M24. We get stuff from Conway. And so in particular, sigma models are only just a convenient perturbative lens for studying these symmetries so far. How do we get the full Umbral groups? Where are they? In particular, how could we realize them in string theory that involves K3 somehow? And so in the last few minutes, I'd like to transition a bit to my more recent work with Katru and Volpato. So where are the Umbral groups? That's the question. Can we actually realize them as symmetries of certain string theories? And it turns out the answer is yes. And we were motivated to look in a very particular place. Namely, let's think about compactification down to three dimensions on K3 times T3. Let's think of 2a on K3 times T3. Or we could think about it in another perturbative frame as the heterotic string on T7 by string duality. So those are natural places to look in three dimensions. And now, okay, why were we motivated to look at those string compactifications other than the fact that there's still a K3 floating around? And it turns out that the moduli space has a very nice and beautiful structure in three dimensions, studied by Marcus Schwartz and Sen. So this moduli space is a double coset space. It kind of looks familiar from the moduli space of Narayan compactifications, but I have to stress that it's actually not a Narayan moduli space. In particular, from the heterotic string on T7, you would expect a double coset space of signature 7,23, which would include the usual metric in B-field and Wilson line moduli. But in three dimensions, it turns out that you may know that you can dualize vector fields to scalars. So we get an additional 30 scalars, in addition to the usual perturbative moduli, and also the dilaton gets mixed up in this coset. So in total, we have a coset of signature 824. And so I just want to stress that this is a non-perturbative moduli space. Generically, the string coupling is going to be of order one everywhere on the moduli space. So this is an extremely, generally a strongly coupled and sort of tricky place to look. But you can think of this moduli space as the moduli space of 32-dimensional, even self-dual lattices of the appropriate signature. So a particular point in moduli space is specified by one of these lattices. And immediately we can see, well, there are 24 very special points on this moduli space that should have huge symmetry groups. So it's natural to look at the 24 places in moduli space where the 32-dimensional even self-dual lattice of a given signature splits into a direct sum of an even self-dual lattice of dimension 24 and an even self-dual lattice of dimension 8. And we know there's 24 places where this splitting happens. Well, firstly, there's only one choice for an even self-dual 8-dimensional lattice. That's the E8 root lattice. But as I mentioned earlier in the talk, there are 24 choices for an even self-dual lattice of rank 24, namely the Leech and the 23 Neumeier lattices. So if we're motivated to look for string theory, string theoretic compactifications that have symmetries related to automorphism groups of these lattices, this is an extremely natural place to look. And so again, just to remind you, the 23 Neumeier lattices have as their group of automorphisms the umbral group with some semi-direct product of the spiral group, and the Leech lattice has as its group of automorphisms the Conway group, Conway 0, which has already been playing a very prominent role in classifying symmetries of K3 sigma models. So essentially all the groups we care about are realized already on this three-dimensional moduli space. And what can we learn, knowing that these automorphism groups are there and part of the uduality group of these models? Well, so this is just the cartoon picture that I want you to keep in mind. What we showed is the following. In three dimensions, again, there are 24 special points where the lattice is split. And we showed in particular that if you start at one of these 24 special points, choose a direction in moduli space along which you can deform, preserving the maximal possible symmetry group that you can. You can actually go to a perturbative heterotic limit in 3D, where you preserve exactly the full umbral group. So that's the first thing. So we actually have concrete string compactifications where the umbral group is just part of the group of symmetries. So that's nice. And it was a surprise that we could actually realize this in a perturbative limit, because as I was saying, this moduli space, generally the dilaton is mixed up with the other scalars and it's strongly coupled. But on the other hand, we might also like to go to a perturbative limit on the 2A side. And it turns out that you can do this. Again, you start at the 24 special points, choose a direction, and try to preserve the most symmetry that you possibly can. And what you find was that as the 2A string coupling goes to zero, and additionally you can choose to decompactify the extra T3, you find that you break the symmetries that you get in the three-dimensional picture to exactly the subgroups of Conway or the umbral groups that are guaranteed by the GHP classification of sigma models. So we've showed that this 3D picture, where we really genuinely have the umbral symmetries, dovetails perfectly with the 6D perturbative picture, where we had a classification of the allowable sigma model symmetries. So this is suggestive to us that perhaps the origin of the umbral group symmetries, including M24, as well as Conway, the origin is a lower dimensional one, and you can exactly see how the symmetries break and to what when you recover the 6D limit and study sigma models on K3 again.
So the symmetries act on the perturbative state, but also on deeper ends and S5 ends?
Sorry?
Do the symmetries only act on the perturbative spectrum or also on deeper ends and S5 ends and stuff?
In 3D?
Yeah.
It should act on everything.
But you're in the perturbative regime, though.
Well.
So does this symmetry mix string states with deeper ends?
It should, yeah. I mean, we can take a perturbative limit and show that the umbral group is still a symmetry of the low energy effective action. There's a perturbative heterotic regime where the symmetry is preserved. But in general, you can also, I mean, the umbral group symmetries will be at non-perturbative points in the moduli space as well. So it's really, it's a symmetry of the full string theory in 3D. But I think it is nice that you can actually preserve the full symmetry in some perturbative. Right, so just to stress a little bit what I've said so far, one of the things we did particularly was study a certain four derivative coupling in the low energy effective action, which is saturated by half BPS states, and we computed it in the vicinity of these Neumeier points and showed that the BPS states do indeed decompose in EREPs of the umbral groups and the Conway zero group. And again, just to stress, near these strongly coupled Neumeier points, there are theories with umbral group symmetry. And again, we can take a 3D heterotic limit such that the heterotic string coupling goes to zero and preserve the full umbral group symmetries. And we can indeed see that these half BPS states in the coupling transform in the 23-dimensional EREP of the umbral groups. But when we try to take a perturbative 2A limit, we immediately break the umbral groups and the Conway group down to the subgroups predicted by the GHV classification and recover the sigma model classification of symmetries in that way. But of course, even though I believe that this is a promising starting point to really understand and explain all of umbral moonshine, this lower dimensional picture, there are still many open questions that I haven't told you about. Namely, moonshine is sort of a two-pronged beast. There's finite groups and there's Mach modular forms or modular objects. And I've told you where I believe the symmetries are hidden, but the question is, if that's correct, how do I get all the umbral Mach modular forms from this 3D picture? Perhaps there's some counts of quarter BPS states or their completions are. And in particular, I'd also like to be able to recover the decomposition of the K3 elliptic genus in the perturbative limit. So I should be able to do that if the 3D picture is the actual explanation for the umbral moonshine observations. And a little bit more of a precise question, can we start from this 3D picture and actually use that to make precise predictions for which twining genera appear at different points in moduli space, which is one of the open questions left over from my work with Chang, Harrison, and Ferrari. So does the 3D picture actually tell us exactly which Niemeyer lattice governs which point of the higher dimensional moduli space? That's work in progress by some of my collaborators. Another obvious question is, can the 3D picture connect to any of the existing proposals for understanding the new moonshine in other contexts? And of course, once we understand the Mathieu and umbral moonshine observations, we'd really like to figure out, given that K3 is so central for much of the physics, for a lot of physics and string theory that we're very interested in, what are the ramifications of understanding these new umbral symmetries for, say, string theory dualities, really any regime in which K3 has played an interesting role. Another aspect of this kind of moonshine that I'm very interested in is really the ramifications for algebraic geometry, because really this is the first instance of moonshine that's actually brought in a geometric object in a precise way, namely the K3 surface, but also by string dualities, you might imagine other K3 fibered Calabi-Yaus implicated in this umbral moonshine story, and so on and so forth. In fact, even the double coset space, that's the moduli space, is an interesting object in mathematics, so I'd like to understand the geometric ramifications for understanding this new class of moonshines. And more broadly, I mean, we'd like to ask, where else in string theory does moonshine appear? Is it restricted to K3, or can we find new interesting finite symmetry groups in other Calabi-Yau manifolds, the elliptic genera of other manifolds of exceptional holonomy, in other supersymmetric systems? Really, what's the extent of this new class of symmetries that we're just starting to understand? And with that, thanks for your attention.
Questions? I mean, there are higher dimensional kind of avatars of elliptic genus.
Yes.
That Hill is percoformal index?
Yes.
Are there such mysterious relations for some, say, interesting CFTs in higher dimensions?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the systems that I've studied a little bit a long time ago, but I would like to revisit, that I think might be promising, might be the elliptic genera of these M-strings by Goffman and collaborators, which are these M2 brains suspended between some M5 brains. I'm not positive that there would be interesting moonshine there, but I think, you know, non-critical strings are other theories might be interesting places to look, but I have no.
But I meant even above higher dimensions, like this is conformal index, like in 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, you know, I haven't looked, and I'm not sure. It's a good question.
Let's stand up, read again.